Thursday, September 19th, 2013. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Polk Runyon. And tonight we present a discussion on Soma, the elixir of immortality, in the shamanic, Magian, Vedic, Mithriatic, Orphic, magical, and alchemical traditions. We will refer to the works of Gordon Wasson, Andrija Puharic, Clark Heinrich, James Arthur, and Carl Ruck, along with the personal reflections of a magician familiar with the sacrament's use in magical practice. Now, although the use of this entheogen is legal, we do not require it in our degrees, and we don't recommend it, and we will provide no detailed instructions for its use. However, we would be skipping over a very significant aspect of the Western and the Eastern magical traditions if we ignored Soma. Let me assure you that if you are so confused about the identity of the legendary magical plant and its effectiveness, your questions will be answered tonight. So, as we said, tune in and we will go in search of the food of the gods. Well, regardless of whether or not the entheogen that we're discussing is legal or not, this is still a controversial subject. And therefore, we'll try to get as much meaningful information across without rubbing too many people the wrong way. Now, the reason why this is important, whether it's a part of a program, a magical program or not, is because of its tremendous influence and importance through the last probably 10,000 years of history, all the way from Central Asia across to Northern Europe, down into Persia, and down into India, this is the primary magical agent, mystical agent that was used by European Vikings, berserkers, witches, and even werewolves, and yeah, I mean real werewolves, I don't mean the Hollywood variety, and the shamans of Siberia, Mongolia, and the Altai Mountains, where this all got started way back in Paleolithic times, and spread along that river of grass, that river of grass that flows all the way from the Altai, all the way into Hungary and into the Carpathians, that river of grass that has borne the Scythians, the Turks, the Mongols, and all of the conquerors of Central Asia, the original Aryans who became the Persians and who created one of the first and the oldest religions, especially the oldest monotheistic religion in the world, Zoroastrianism. And this offshoot of Zoroastrianism, the Magian tradition. And the Magian tradition, by the way, obviously harkens back to its Central Asian shamanic roots. The Magians were, and that's where we get, by the way, that is where the word magic comes from, the Magians. Remember the three wise men that supposedly brought the gifts to the Christ child? Yeah, they were supposed to be Magian priests from Persia. These were not really kosher Zoroastrians. In fact, they were a rebellious sect. And they were originally the Medes, not the Persians. The Persians, the Zoroastrians, conquered the Medes back 1000 BC or something like that. And the Magians were the Medes, their sorcerous cult. And one of the things about the Magians that we might mention is that they, being rebels and rebelling against Zoroastrianism, which was very transcendental, as you recall. Zoroaster was the great prophet of Uhura Mazda, the god of light. And the Persian Satan was called Ahriman, and he was the god of illusion, darkness, and evil. Well, the Magians, they were heretical, and so they, being rebellious and being magicians, they propitiated Ahriman along with Uhura Mazda. And they also had shared a god, a minor god for the Zoroastrians, and it became eventually a major god growing out of Magian tradition, Mithra, the sun god. Mithra was also showed his central Asian origin by being the god of the wide pastures. He was a god of the Central Asian cowboys, actually, because the Mithrites, as you know, sacrificed bulls and cattle. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning all this is that the Zoroastrians, the Vedic tradition comes from these Aryan Zoroastrians, and they invaded India back about 1500 BC. They invaded India and conquered it. And this, these Aryans brought with them their traditions and their gods, and that became the origin of Hinduism, Brahmanism, and they had, the Aryans had, and the Magians also had, and we think now we think also the Mithrites had, a sacrament. And this sacrament was a magical plant that they deified. They called this plant Soma. In India, they called it Soma. In Persia, it was referred to as Hyoma. But this magical plant that they partook of, and they worshipped the plant as a god, and they partook of the plant, and they had ecstatic experiences. And they wrote voluminous poems about this, and they wrote incredible scriptures about this, about these experiences with this plant. It was a sacrament. And so the mystery has come down to us as to just exactly what this plant was, because the present-day substitutes for it just simply did not fill the bill. It didn't match the poetry, the poetic descriptions at all, and some of the substitutes that are still used, by the way, by Zoroastrian descendants and some people in India, but these substitutes simply just didn't fill the bill on this, and so the secret of Soma apparently was lost. Well, that condition went on for quite a while, and nobody seemed to really care that much on this side of the world. But then, in 1957, a mushroom expert by the name of Gordon Wasson, 1957, published an article in Life magazine, and I recall, it shows you how old I am, I recall that article. And here he was, oh boy, yeah, the great big full page, double page spread, and there he is sitting there watching the scientist, and sitting there in Mexico with these Mexican Indian women and men, and they're in this little hovel, and they're all I think they're smoking these mushrooms, and that this was the psilocybin mushroom, and this was this little mushroom cult that Wasson had discovered down in Mexico. And of course, psilocybin, it's a little bitty mushroom, and it's a very, very tiny little thing. And it sometimes there are different strains of it, different species of it, but most of it is small. And sometimes it grows on dung, and that's one version of it, and it can be different sizes, but it's usually very small little bullet shaped thing. Anyway, they had these wonderful visions, taking this mushroom and eating it, and smoking it, doing various things with it, and Wasson was just absolutely fascinated. So he wrote this article and did this research. And then this opened up a line of inquiry, and people began to think maybe there might be something, a mushroom connection with the ancient lost formula for soma. And sure enough, it began to occur to people that up there in the Altai region, and I'm just looking at large psilocybin over here that Andrea is showing me. So yeah, there are larger varieties of it, but most of the ones that seem to be rather small, but there's larger versions of it. Anyway, what began to be considered at this point was that there was a not a cult necessarily, but indigenous people up in Siberia had been using Amanita muscaria, which is phylogeric or this, you know, the red top mushroom with the white spots on the top of it, and they've been using this for since time immemorial as an intoxicant up in Siberia, and even the reindeer would eat it, and the reindeer would stagger around, they would take the mushrooms and they would dry them, and then they would eat them, and of course, and then and then they would urinate, and then they would go after the chamber pots and recycle, you know, their own urine. And the Siberian people were very, very real cold up there, and they were really miserable, and so, you know, this was about the best they could do. And the poor Siberians, who couldn't even afford the mushrooms, they had to go to the wealthier Siberians, and I don't know what a wealthier Siberian would be like necessarily, but at least they could afford the mushrooms. And so all the poor guys could afford was to get a drink out of their chamber pots. And they were getting really, really drunk and intoxicated. As far as the anthropologists could determine, they were good. And nobody seemed to particularly want to find out what it was they were experiencing, but this was known. So the idea occurred after Wasson had gotten started with his psilocybin research that maybe this was soma, because it could have come down from Central Asia into the Iranian area very easily. It grows, by the way, under trees, under pine trees, birch trees, oak trees. In other words, temperate zone, high altitude trees. And it won't grow anywhere else. It grows under these trees, and it only grows, I don't know, usually about once a year, and it'll come up, and you better go out and harvest it quick. And so it's kind of capricious as far as the harvesting is concerned and whatever. But the idea began to percolate that maybe this was the original soma. And the first serious book on this came out, as far as I know, was Sacred Mushroom by Andrija Puharik, and this came out in 1959. And Puharik was a parapsychologist in Yugoslavia, and he was migrated to this country, and he was working with a psychic by the name of Harry Stone, who had visions of the ancient Egyptians using this Amanita muscaria. Now, Amanita muscaria is absolutely not indigenous to ancient Egypt. I mean, really, it's not. The nearest place they could possibly get it would be up in the cedars of Lebanon, perhaps up around the mountains in Lebanon. It may be a bit of a stretch, but he was Harry Stone, the psychic, was babbling in ancient Egyptian, and there's no way he could know ancient Egyptian, and so Puharik was, taking all this down. And began to get this idea that the ancient Egyptians were using this mushroom as a spy guard. And generally, Harry, as I recall, now I got the book sitting right here before me, but I may be wrong here, but I think when Harry started off, he wasn't taking the mushroom, but then he took it, and they didn't know how to take it, actually. And Harry got sick, as I recall, that Amanita, even though that we knew the Siberians were doing it, it had a bad reputation, and it was supposed to be toxic. In fact, some handbooks even said it was deadly. So Andrija Puharik and Harry Stone did not know how to use it. But the book was out, and Puharik was the first one to come up with the idea that Amanita had a telepathic capacity, and that's since been discovered and dealt with by several writers, including Mark Heinrich more recently. Anyway, so following Andrew Puharik and Andrija Puharik, a guy by the name of John Allegro. This guy was on the Dead Sea Scrolls Committee, and he was kind of a nasty atheist, and he hated Jews, and he hated Christians, and he made an enemy out of everybody on the Dead Sea Scroll Committee. Which was, by the way, not hard to do, as you recall. The head of the Dead Sea Scroll Committee quit in a huff and drank himself to death, as I recall. And then they finally dumped the whole thing on the Huntington Library and said, here, publish it all. But anyway, John Allegro really he really irritated everybody on that committee. Then he came out with his book called, based upon Puharik, obviously, he came out with his book called The Mushroom of the Cross. And Jesus and the whole business of Christianity was an Amanita mushroom cult. And, of course, naturally, Jesus was giving living water to this didn't. His scholarship wasn't all that good, and he had an axe to grind, and so that didn't do very well. But following Allegro, very shortly, comes Wasson. And Wasson, of course, was quite a scholar, and he'd already done this thing on psilocybin. So Wasson does this magisterial treatise, great big, fat, thick book called Soma, the mushroom of immortality. Ooh, boy, and he really did the research, and he traced it all the way down from Siberia and down into the Vedic, into Persia and down into India, and he just really piled on the facts, and he pretty much satisfied himself, at least, and most of his colleagues, there was something to this, that this Amanita was the original Soma of the Aryans, the original magical brew. Well, there was a problem here. in that. Gordon Wasson, for all of his research and all of his scholarship, and he himself was completely convinced that he was right, but he didn't know how to use the mushroom. Now here he'd been taking the psilocybin with the Mexican brujos and brujas and all that, and he'd been doing fine and having visions and everything else. But when it came to Amanita, he didn't know how to use it, and he kept trying and didn't get anywhere. And then he kept trying to make excuses for why he couldn't, get it to do what it would have to do if it was going to be sober. And he, rather than discredit himself, he said, "Oh well, it must be that the people were different. They had a different metabolisms, and there was different ethnicity, and they had a different effect, and maybe the plant was different, and all that." But the plain fact of the matter was, and Wasson wasn't alone, because people really did not know how to use it, not in the West anyway. And so people at this point, scholars and the psychedelic community, as far as that's concerned, they didn't really want to deal with it, because it was not effective, and it was not pleasant, and it was not doing what it was supposed to do, and so it was relegated to the category of a mild hallucinogen, and under other circumstances or whatever, and people began to ignore it. Well, that condition went on, and other psychedelics were quite popular and whatever. Of course, as you recall, Timothy Leary, who frankly, I don't think the psychedelic community is very fond of Timothy Leary, because Timothy Leary literally spoiled it for everybody. He tried to popularize something that should have remained a spiritual thing, and tried to make it a recreational thing, and for political, for some radical political purposes. And as a result of that, the government went on a rampage and just made everything illegal. And except Amanita. They didn't care about Amanita, because Amanita wasn't something that, it wasn't effective, and it wasn't recreational and all that. So they left Amanita alone, but they made everything else illegal. Anyway, it wasn't until actually almost the turn of a century, all the way through into the middle 90s, before we people in the West really found out how to actually use Amanita. And the reason why this was because we didn't know that Amanita is a completely different type of fungus. It is not, it is fundamentally different than psilocybin. It doesn't work the same way as psilocybin, and it doesn't work the same way as other entheogens. The best way to describe it is that Amanita works through and with your digestive system. To say with your digestive system is probably the best way to describe it, which means that in order to use it effectively, you have to clean yourself out. You have to fast for a couple of days and drink a lot of water and get yourself completely cleaned out. And you can't eat anything, put anything on your stomach before you ingest the Amanita. And there are other things about it too. But as I said at the beginning, this is not a workshop class. We're not trying to teach you how to use it or anything like that. But it is important to mention that the proper preparation and use of it, and preparation of the shaman who is going to use it, was something that completely eluded all these people, because they kept trying to compare it, as Wasson did, to psilocybin. And it's not. And it just simply isn't. It doesn't work that way. Amanita, it works with you in an alchemical process inside your body. And sometimes it can take up to 2 hours to actually work its way through, even on an empty stomach, to work, as you'll find out tonight when I recount the experience of a magician who I know who has a rather detailed account of a significant experience. And you'll realize how this entheogen actually does work. Now, once that was realized, and we knew how to do it, then it began, again, people began to take seriously the idea that it really was the original soma. And so we had, following this, we had, let's see, sequence on these books here. I'll come up with them. Clark Heinrich, who lives up in Northern California, I'm not going to say where. He's up in North California. He wrote a wonderful, wonderful book called Strange Fruit, Alchemy and Religion, The Hidden Truth. And Clark, I want to get him on the show tonight, but he demurred. He's a quiet man. It was first published in 1995. And this is a book which primarily connects Amanita, goes all through the Soma Hyoma thing, and it documents all that, and, you know, and cites all the earlier literature. But he's primarily concerned with relating it to European alchemy. And, oh, gosh, he's got evidence in here. He's citing Michael Mayer's Atlanta Fugians and all of the alchemical treatises we know and love, and he's showing where this really was an elixir that was used and processed by the alchemists. And rightly so, because, of course, the process that this material goes through in you is very, very alchemical. And as you know, Chinese alchemy is quite a bit interior, you know, and whatever. And the interior process of digestion is an alchemical process. And he shows, has a whole bunch of exhibits from alchemical treatises to back this up. So, Strange Fruit, Alchemy and Religion, The Hidden Truth. By the way, Clark Heinrich has a new book out. I think it's on Amazon now. What's the title of it, his new book? Or do you remember? Yeah, Clark's, we'll bring it up and make sure we mention it. He has a new one, which looks like it may be a more, probably amplifies on Strange Fruit. Anyway, so this came out in 1995. Now, I know Clark's going to disagree with me here, but I don't think Clark at this time in 1995, I don't think he was completely squared away on how to use this. What's the title? Magic Mushrooms in Religion and Alchemy, Clark Heinrich, Amazon. That'll be a good one. I don't think, frankly, reading through Clark's experiences, I'm not sure he knew completely how to do it, but he came close, a lot closer than Wasson and the rest of them. Now, another book that we've certainly mentioned here, and this one, if you can find it, is really, really a good wrap-up of the whole process, the whole deal. And this is by the late James Arthur. And James Arthur, unfortunately, came to a very sad and strange end. But his book, Mushrooms and Mankind, The Impact of Mushrooms on Human Consciousness and Religion, is really a good one to have. And he does the ancient Egyptian connection. He does the Mithriatic connection. And that's very important, if that's true. I'm not exactly sure, and we'll deal with Mithra next week, but I'm not completely convinced that on the Mithraic thing, but there's good argument for it. And the Santa Claus connection, oh boy, and the Alice in Wonderland connection, on and on and on and on and on, and wonderful set of exhibits and everything in this book, and also his own experiences, what have you. So I'd recommend that one, Mushrooms and Mankind. Now, finally, in our list of books here that we want to mention and discuss, last but not least, Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, subtitled The Drug Cult That Civilized Europe. This is by Carl A. P. Ruck, Mark A. Hoffman, Jose Alfredo Gonzalez Calderon. Oh, boy. And this one just came out in 2011. This is one where Carl Ruck and his friends decide that they are going to set out to prove that Amanita muscaria was the sacred meal of the Mithraites. And they've got a good argument. As I say, I'm not going to say that they're, I would say it's almost overwhelming that Amanita was the soma of the Aryans. Now that and the hyoma, that is overwhelming at this point. But Mithra, the sacred meal of the Mithraites, I still think that's not quite established. But it's certainly this Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras would certainly has a good argument, and they really, really go into, it's just scholarly work, and yet it's very readable. And Mithra, if in case you're wondering, those of you who saw the Leonardo da Vinci's Demons, the TV show, they use this Mithriatic cult that the Sufis were running, and they were getting, they got Leonardo into it, and sure enough, there's a Sufi. There's a Sufi over in England that's running a Mithra, running a revived Mithra cult over there, and we'll get into that next week. And so when you're watching Leonardo on TV, and you keep seeing the lion-headed
Mithra god, you know that there's a connection here,
all the way through to the Hermetic, and very, very deep connection, and with between Mithraism and Alexandrian Hermetic magical cult practice. In fact, one of the Hermetic surviving Hermetic rituals is called the Mithriatic ritual, and Yarker called his 64th degree of Memphis Mizraim. His wrap up of Craterapoa was called the Sage of Mithras, and I can tell you right now that Craterapoa, the degrees, the 7 degrees, the 7 steps, initiatory steps of Mithras, are very, 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 very close to Craterapoa, and obviously had an influence on it. And remember now, Mithra became the most popular and strongest religion among the elite of the Romans and the Roman army. And Constantine, the Red Cross of Constantine, who forced Christianity on the whole Western world, was originally a Mithraite. And the only reason why he imposed Christianity rather than Mithra is that Mithriatic religion is an elite. It's an elite religion. It's like Hermetic religion. It's very close to, it's almost interchangeable in some ways with Hermetic religion. And it's an elite, mystical, very elite. And Constantine realized that Christianity, the way Paul had set it up, was much, much better for political purposes. And that's why I went for it. So this Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras is one that certainly bears the reading. Now, so we have here a massive amount of scholarship and research and all that backs up proposition that the elixir, the great magical agent for the Western tradition is Amanita, which is rather, I suppose, frustrating to people, to some people who think that, well, it ought to be psilocybin. Well, actually, no. Even though psilocybin, I'm not going to say one way or the other, psilocybin, psilocybin is, I have nothing against psilocybin, and I'm not, and I will say I like it, I shouldn't say that. But psilocybin is not Amanita, and Amanita does things that psilocybin doesn't do. And I think when we read this account of this magician, hermetic magician's account of his peak Amanita experience, of the various experiments that he did, when you read that, we'll read that, we'll censor it a little bit for him, because there are certain parts of it that he said he didn't want us to come up with, but they're just that those parts are more or less social. That's personal social stuff, and that has nothing to do with the experience itself. So this is edited with that in mind. So I'm going to read that excerpt from his journal, and this will give you an idea of this experience and how it actually works, at least in a magical context. Now, we'll call him Brother Swim, S-W-I-M. This is April 19th, experiment 3. Fasted all day and drank lots of water. Went for a strenuous hike in the afternoon. I started cooking 20 grams at 5:30 p.m. Took off the heat at 6:10 p.m. Opened the ashram at 6:20. Ceremonially ingested the elixir at 6:30. Urinated a very small amount right after ingesting. Returned to the house, leaving the ashram open but not lit. And after half an hour, I began to feel drowsy, and I lay down on the couch. I played Wagner and Holtz and tried to sleep. Only a slight hypnagogic reverie, but nothing unusual. I decided to go down to the ashram at 7:30. I relit the candles and began to think that I might have been right that we got a poor batch of Amanita. Now, the reason for that is, of course, come on by now. I drank a cup of Recycle at 7:35. It was very alkaline and easy to get down, and I invoked Raphael in the altar crystal and began to note a slight alteration in consciousness, but nothing significant, very, very slight peripheral fractal effect at the lower part of my field of vision. Raphael did comment and told me that this plant alchemy work was important and that we should continue with it. Well, next I tried the soul boat and also found that it was not particularly different from my usual unassisted magical trance state. By 8:30, I was beginning to think the experiment was a dud. I was just about to close the ashram and go up and spend the rest of the evening in mundane space, watching TV or reading. And when I began to get the first indication that it was coming on, my second recycling was the catalyst. Again, as in my first experience, my urinary tract became irritated and I had a burning sensation when voiding. And it tasted acid, and it was yellow in color, and the first had been clear. Apparently, this was finally the real thing. Now we were off and running. Flashing and fractalizing visual effects began, this time showing up like bits of disjointed collage clip art from a memory file, little snippets of decorative trivia, but with the characteristic blue and white patterning predominating. By 9 p.m., I was really into it. I went back to the soul boat and had the wonderful experience of having the gate open for me in a fully spiritualized 3D effect. And this could only be described as a 3D sensation experienced on several levels simultaneously. I closed my eyes and flew into the dark mirror, but was not as fully projected as I had hoped. The sensation was still in my imagination rather than totally, totally extrapersonal. And next, I used the dark mirror, and this time in the east quadrant, and used frankincense, and I got Cagliostro. And the visual was very fluid, but the contact was very strong. And he said he was, that's personal, and that he was connected with the Crater of Poet tradition and the seven planetary angels. Now, the rest of this Cagliostro reception is a bit personal, so we're going to skip over it. Not that it wasn't strong, it was very strong, but I went back to the big mirror and enjoyed it so much that I decided to rig it up for the ceiling using the tatwas and scry from a reclining position. Now, this was the ultimate experience, especially with the fire tatwa at the climax of the experience. I entered or expanded my consciousness to actually become a god. This is utterly indescribable, and it was not an hallucination because the mirror and the tatwa remained in view, but my environment and my self-awareness became transformed into a state of cosmic consciousness that Walter Stace would call undifferentiated unity. And yet this was even beyond the samadhi state achieved in yoga and meditation. It was as if that sensation was squared. And I see he has a note here, omega squared. I am now totally convinced that Watson was right. This is the religious mystical teacher of the ancients. Nothing, not psilocybin, LSD, hashish, or anything I have experienced can compare to this godlike feeling. Following this, I ingested more acidious yellow impregnated recycle, but by this time I had peaked, even though the agent was still going strong. At this point, and I wanted to close the ashram and do the rest of the journey upstairs in a reflective mode. I did, and I went up very much in the state. I was still snapping and twitching and getting fractal peripherals. And I recycled again, and I had two trips to the bathroom during this adventure. And at this point, I made a technical mistake. I was very hungry, and I decided, while still in the state, but physically exhausted, to eat a chocolate pudding. It tasted great, but I went to bed, and then I had the hypnagogic and I had a hypnagogic dream state I had missed earlier. Now, these dreams were very, very indicative of a dimensional shift or an interpenetration, and this was an amplification fractal and fracture effect, showing a strange mechanical electrical map, like the universal structure of my brain in a glimpse or segmented view. And the colors were again blue and white, but not so bright. And these structures or decorated surfaces seemed round and polished as if printed on ivory ceramic surfaces, and the blue, the blue plate china effect, except the patterning is more like computer chips. And currently, an aerial photo map of city streets and buildings. And this is from memory, like the earlier trivia chip art displays. No, I think that here at this point we are really seeing into another dimension, another level of reality. I had gone to bed at 11:30 after eating the pudding, and after the hypnagogic dream state, I drifted into a deep sleep to be awakened an hour or so later, finding that the pudding had made its way through me. Never again, the pudding. And I had to, And all in all, this was a very significant event, and yet I am not anxious to repeat it anytime soon. It was a great adventure, but spiritually overwhelming and exhausting. And I think higher doses of Amanita are better for general magical. I think that higher doses of Amanita are better for general magical work, but And that concludes this particular experience. And I think we can say from that that this is the sort of feeling the whole Soma poetry, the Soma poetry indicates. Justifies the feeling of the berserks, the Nordic berserks to describe. This is the godlike, weightless, super strong feeling that the Siberian shamans describe. This is a tremendous stimulant in a spiritual sense. And this godlike feeling is really what has been characteristic of the Soma experience. And so I think, based upon what Brother Swim has experienced there, I would say that yes, Lawson was certainly right. And wouldn't it have been nice if poor old Dr. Watson had known how to actually use it, and perhaps he would have had this experience himself. This brings us really to the point where we have to consider that this is a part, definitely, an aspect of both the Western and the Eastern magical traditions. And so, with that in mind, we have included, in our alchemical degree in Krakatoa, we've included a poem of mine to pay tribute to it in the alchemical, in our alchemical degree, in our fifth degree. And I will read you that poem. It's in the seventh ray, by the way, the green ray, which is our best one, and that's the one that's our latest seventh ray, the seventh ray, the green ray, book 3. You can get it on Amazon. And this is the poem. The master of this sacred art sun dries the rosy blood of God, grinds it to a powder fine, simmers it for an hour's time, laces it with honey sweet, and bravely quaffs it down. And then upon his couch to dream, a requiem of symbols seen, in further memory's endless scene, and etched upon the inner walls of vastly vaulted, darkened halls. Then rises he, a god reborn, to drink again and yet again, elixir from the fount within, distilling droplets of his mind from vapors of his soul. He'll scry a most enchanted way by crystal orb and speculum to realms amid the stars, where angels love and demons lust, beyond the moons of Mars. Yeah. And so, with that in mind, I ask you to be sure and tune in next week, when we will delve into the mysteries of the cult of Mithras, and we'll find out just what our Hollywood screenwriters thought Leonardo da Vinci was getting into, and the relationship of the cult of Mithras to the Hermetic tradition, and the Crater of Poa. And so, until then, good magic.